Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. As China becomes ever more assertive across Asia, the United States Navy has surged capabilities worldwide with seven of its 11 aircraft carriers now underway and at least seven of its Guam and Hawaii-based submarines rapidly deployed to the Western Pacific. The destroyers Barry and Peralta, as well as the cruiser Bunker Hill and the littoral combat ship Giffords, have been conducting freedom of navigation operations through the Taiwan Strait and other international waters that China claims. This comes a month after a bruising black eye for the Navy as the coronavirus sidelined the carrier Theodore Roosevelt in an incident that also cost Acting Navy Secretary Tom Modley his job. Beijing has expressed outrage, saying that the provocative acts, quote, seriously violated China's sovereignty and security interests, deliberately increased regional security risks, and could easily trigger an unexpected incident, end quote. The Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Mike Gilday, has tweeted that the Navy is a force for good, but also a force to be reckoned with, as his public affairs team penned an unprecedented commentary making the same point. Joining us now to discuss what all this means and, most importantly, what's next is retired United States Navy Commander Brian McGrath of the Ferry Bridge Consultancy, who's also a former commanding officer of USS Bulkley, guided missile destroyer, our very own contributing editor Chris Cavas, who's one of the world's finest naval writers, and our producer Chris Cervello, who's also a retired commander and former Navy public affairs officer. Guys, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
Thanks, Vago.
Good to be back.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinet Marine sponsors our naval coverage. Elbit Systems of America sponsors our virtual coverage of Quad A and the SOFIC trade shows. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Okay, guys, let's put this into context. Chinese Premier Xi Jinping has been wounded at home in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as the success of the Hong Kong democracy movement. He's now asserting authority with obviously the new Hong Kong law, but as well as stepping up pressure across the region, not just against Taiwan, Vietnam, Indonesia, and other nations in the Asia Pacific, but as well as bullying Australia and even Europe to an extent. Brian, what does this surge deployment mean? Is it going to be the kind of deterrent message in terms of what the CNO is talking about, a force to reckon with? And what's the Navy doing to get ready for the Chinese response? You know, a couple of years ago, you and I were talking about the need to practice shouldering maneuvers where you deliberately trade paint with your ship and another ship in a controlled manner. But that's just the first step in the escalation ladder. Walk us through how you see this and how the Navy is getting ready for step two of this, because it's going to escalate.
I think the Navy is doing the best job it can with the forces it has to show a series of demonstrations about why naval forces are important. And that is that in addition to the warfighting punch they are a signaling force that that shows American resolve and American will around the world in places that matter to us, at times that matter to us. And so this deployment of submarines, this discussion of the aircraft carriers being underway, all of that is part of a messaging campaign, but it's also a demonstration of what navies, and especially the U.S. Navy, can uniquely do. The problem we have, or at least that I, as I see it, is that because of the responsibilities and the desires for this force and the paucity of force available to fill those desires, we wind up with more episodic and sort of spasmodic reactions than we do some sort of a background music of power and vigor in your face, which is what I would like to see more of.
And I want to come back to that theme in a moment, Brian. But Cavas, I want to go to you. A couple of months ago, you were the first person to point out that the United States had no carriers deployed at all anywhere around the world for the first time since the end of World War II. Whereas now we know that Truman, Eisenhower, Nimitz, Ford, Lincoln, Reagan, and Roosevelt are all underway, albeit Ford is in a slightly different category in a workup mode. You've been talking to Navy leaders, including Acquisition Chief Hondo Gertz. How's the Navy managed to surge this kind of capability this quickly? Because I know that there's an enormous amount of work that's gone into this beforehand. But talk to us about where we were and how we got to where we are.
I think first, I'm not sure what we're seeing is a surge. Roger, that some people are interpreting it that way and talking about it that way. This is not an unprecedented number, but we're also seeing worldwide, almost on a daily basis, ships are starting to set endurance marks, endurance records. They're being out much longer than they were planned to do and they're normally expected to do because of fears of putting into port and getting the virus. So a lot of, Harry Truman has been home for 5 weeks, has been, normally they would have kind of like, I think about April 13th, somewhere around that. They finished their deployment to the Fifth Fleet CENTCOM area and came home and have not put into Norfolk, which is what they normally would have done. They have stayed out at sea as the ready carrier and are being constantly resupplied. That's not normal. That's not a surge. That's not a power demonstration. That's fear of getting the virus directly. You can take a picture of that one. There are others where there are, what we're seeing is a mix of maybe a surge, maybe a power demonstration to some extent, but also very much a fear of ships not getting the virus. Just a further example of that, the 7th Fleet flagship Blue Ridge put a notice out that they'd been underway for 65 entire days in a row, which is the longest that ship had been underway since 1972. That's nice. But also the next day, an Indian offshore patrol ship got back from a anti-piracy patrol, had been at sea for 80 days, resupplied by American and Indian supply ships. That is an endurance mark that's totally due to the virus. So you're seeing this worldwide activity of ships trying to get out and stay out. And that's not necessarily a power demonstration. You could argue that one or two of the other carriers are the same thing. So yes, there seems to be something of a heightened surge, but it's not surge with a purpose. There's no coagulation of ships anywhere. There's no major exercise going on. The power demonstrations they've been doing tend to be with other nations. They come together and do a photo op rather quickly at the top of an exercise rather than at the end of it, which is the traditional spot for that photo X. And they take a picture and then they kind of go their own way again. So they're trying to present a picture of power, but they're not necessarily demonstrating it right now.
Every military force tries to make lemonade when confronted with a lot of lemons. At the end of the day, even if your ships are staying out because you're trying to avoid a virus, that gives you an opportunity to trumpet the fact that you've got capability that's out and forward. But the question is, how much work was necessary to get to the point where you can get so many of the carriers back into service? Because one of the challenges was that a lot of them were sidelined by maintenance, which is one of the reasons why they were not available, right?
And they're deferring maintenance right now. That's part of managing the effect of the virus on the yards and on the shore infrastructure, is seeing what they can put off. They are prioritizing jobs and putting things away. And frankly, keeping a ship at sea is making some of those decisions easier. So you have all these surplus destroyers that are available to do missions. You've got them in the Pacific, in the far Pacific. The Theodore Roosevelt just spent a month and a half, 7 weeks really, in port in Guam. You know, that was a forced port period. Her task force did not get, her strike group did not get the virus. So you had a cruiser and several destroyers that were available for other tasking, and they've been doing that. Similarly, in the Atlantic Fleet, you have a surplus of surface ships available right now for the same reason. The ships that came back with the Truman, a lot of those destroyers now are down running around the Caribbean and the off Venezuela. Same thing with the ships from Teddy Roosevelt's group. The kid, the other destroyer that got the virus, was actually part of the Teddy Roosevelt strike group. She should have been in Westpac, but they had her off retasked doing some sort of demonstration effort in off Venezuela. So we have a surfeit. I'm not sure how many destroyers right now. It could be half a dozen destroyers, plus an LCS, Detroit, doing counter drug ops off Venezuela, which is, I mean, you certainly don't need $2 billion multi-capable, multi-mission destroyers going down doing any drug ops off Venezuela. And are also trying to threaten the Maduro administration because most Americans are clamoring for a conflict with Venezuela.
Well, but that was also one of those slow news day things where all of a sudden it caught everybody off guard when that announcement was made, or it was a tough news mm-hmm. day and seen as a bit of a distraction. I want to go to Cervello for a moment, Chris, because we haven't heard from you. How's the messaging campaign on this? Because you don't often see the Chief of Naval Operations team qualified and capable as they are penning commentaries and stuff like that. How's the communications part of this been going down? Because you've seen this news sort of in, you know, sort of immediate naval circles if you're paying attention to it, but there hasn't really been much broader coverage to date about this.
It feels very disjointed, and that's not a poke at those that are tactically executing the messaging. So it's certainly not a poke at the CNO staff or the CNO. I think that the Navy finds itself squeezed between a national security strategy, a defense strategy, and a maritime strategy, none of which really exist, and none of which really have been prioritized and executed with any sort of discipline. So in terms of messaging, it becomes very difficult to be consistent and be aligned to a larger strategy. You lay that on top of the other kind of events that Brian and Chris and you just discussed. I mean, so you've got issues now with China. 3 weeks ago, it looked like we were going to have conflict with Iran. And then, you know, we're bouncing around in the Caribbean, you know, going after drug dealers and potentially deterring and who knows what with Venezuela. So I think from a messaging standpoint, it's very difficult to be consistent and be deliberate in what the Navy messages on behalf of the government writ large, and on behalf of the capabilities that they want to prioritize moving forward.
I wonder whether or not the deployment of that ship had anything to do with that half-cocked coup attempt where people were effectively arrested on the beaches, you know, a couple of weeks ago. It just seems interesting to me that those ships made it down there, you know, roughly at the same time all of that stuff was brewing. I don't want to get any hairs started on that. Brian, you know, this administration is composed of many people who are very tough on China and rightly tough on China and have sort of the vision of a competition between the United States and the need for pressure and the need to stand up and a need to push back. But the president's focus very, very much has been on trade deals that appease his base sort of more specifically on that. And the president is willing to direct ire and compliments to the Chinese leadership effectively for that aim at the end of the day. What happens if the Chinese take this opportunity, as many people think they will, as their moment, step things up, and we do not react? Or actually, we and the other nations in the region don't react, because as Kavis said, some of these are just photo op exercises, right? They're not actually doing as much stuff as we would like them to be doing. And the trouble with doing that is your adversary always knows when you're serious and when you're screwing around.
Well, I think the concept of demonstrating will to an opponent or potential opponent is a critical component of deterrence. And if the Chinese decide to respond in a way that suggests aggression or a higher level of tension, and we don't do anything, or we don't do anything that appears to be or is effective in countering that, then we will have made a giant mistake and we will have set back our own reputation as a force to be depended on and as a partner you can trust. The Pacific security arrangement, to the extent that it exists at all, is one built on trust. There are, in fact, individual treaties, but they are bilateral. There is no NATO for the Western Pacific. It's all about trust. It's about everybody thinking that America has your back. I realize that that is a bugaboo for a lot of people who think that America shouldn't be doing that sort of thing. But I'm a foreign policy primacist. I think that's exactly what we should be doing. And the degree to which we tack away from that reputational approach and that approach to assurance and deterrence is the extent to which insecurity will begin to grow, and China will make accelerated gains in its plan to become the dominant Pacific power.
Let me ask you one follow-up, though. What are some of the things the Navy has been doing to prepare its ship commanders and crews to trade paint, to shoulder, and to be better prepared, right? There's a note to mariners about approach to U.S. warships that's gone out to the region. But more importantly, the Chinese are operating in a very, very hybrid fashion with fishing militias and coast guards and other government agencies that are becoming involved in complicating the sea space, right? I mean, surging you literally with a whole bunch of garbage that you've got to sort through and ships that you're trying not to collide with, right? I mean, everything is done to stymie or to, be causus belli in some cases, right? I mean, oh, you ran over one of my fishing ships. I had to open fire on you, right? At the end of the day, how are we thinking through and preparing our folks for everything from, you know, water hoses to contact to something potentially worse?
Well, first of all, I think the notice to mariners that was put out earlier this week, my understanding is that it was regionally focused, sort of in the Middle East, but that kind of a message, I'm sure, resonated with our friends in China, that, you know, the U.S. Navy is has set a new sort of baseline, right? Don't come 100 meters or whatever. I think it's 100 meters from our warships. I am looking forward to that same kind of a notice going out and to as a worldwide thing to make sure people understand that it's unsafe and it's unprofessional and that we won't tolerate it. The training and the kinds of things that individual ship captains are receiving in order to prepare themselves for a closer relationship, and I mean that physically, with our friends from China, I honestly don't know. I know that in fleet exercises and the like, we routinely task ship captains to put themselves between this ship and that ship. We don't practice the trading of paint and what it takes to deliver a glancing blow. That sort of thing is not, to my knowledge, practiced underway, and I don't know whether our trainers have the fidelity to recreate such an interaction. In fact, I doubt it.
Well, I remember having talked to Coast Guard Commandant Schultz about that and the need that, you know, that's something you got to prepare for, and it's better to prepare for that before you're going to have to do it, given that you're going to, you know, you're operating in an environment that includes people who will have to do that. And obviously that's a much more important thing when you're...
I think that's an easier and less risky proposition when you don't have $2 million rubber tires covering a sonar dome in the front of your ship like we have.
Yes, and we can get into the details of whether hull-mounted sonars are in that case a better thing or not. Chris, let me both Chris's. Let's get your guys' take and sense on this as well, and whether or not in this escalation, you know, that sets the foundation for a potentially kinetic exchange. And then I want to move talk a little bit about the incoming Navy Secretary Rear Admiral Ken Braithwaite, who's been now confirmed by the Senate and will become the nation's next Navy Secretary. Chris?
The deal with, if we put out warnings to mariners, notices to mariners that anybody who comes within 100 meters of a U.S. naval vessel may be interpreted as a threat and subject to lawful defensive measures, well, anybody else can do that too. And you can also do that as a pretext to stage an event. So if the Chinese decide to do that, if they and why not? I mean, we just did it. Why wouldn't they do it? I kind of expect them to do it right now. If they put that sort of notice out in and you talk about these flashpoints in the South China Sea, all the artificial reefs, the islands where we're making fun ops. Well, we make a fun ops and they decide to cross our bow. And they just told us that, you know, if you're within 100 meters of us, we're going to continue to take it a threat. But they take an aggressive course to put themselves on that and expect us to fall away. And then we say, no, we're doing, you know, freedom of innocent passage here. So this puts out a pretty tough situation for the commander on the spot. What's the what are the directions for that right now? I don't know, but that could easily be used as a flashpoint. If we do it, why wouldn't they do it? And if they do it, why wouldn't they set up a confrontation in that mode? So I think it's very dangerous. I mean, you know, tit for tat. So just expect it. Are we training for it? I'm not sure we're training for it. Actually, Brian and I had a discussion the other day about shouldering exercises. And I know Brian has done them as a commanding officer. I've witnessed them as a reporter embarked on destroyers and exercises. And I know that these are aggressive tactics. And the Navy, in order to practice them, you have to be able to be aggressive with your nice, big, expensive ship. And occasionally, those ships do ding each other. It just kind of comes with the training. Are we still practicing that? It appears that we're not practicing that with the aggressiveness or vigor that we were maybe a decade ago. So are we ready for that? I don't know. Well, this is something to watch.
Well, those ships are not designed purely to be pretty at the end of the day. They're designed to do something. And it goes back to the will and the mastery with which you're handling your asset. And one of the tenets of Chinese strategy is to be so persistent, be such a juggernaut, that eventually your will to push back evaporates. And that's how that goalpost continuously, each one of these goalposts have been moved. They're so relentless that Indonesia fights and fights and fights, and I'm going to preserve access to my drilling rig, and then eventually puts a big show of force and the Chinese back down. But everybody in that drama understands that the Chinese will come back, and on the fifth one of these, the Indonesians are never likely to go back to that sea space again, and so the Chinese win and move that goalpost a little bit. So this is sort of that incremental, you just keep pressure up on everybody. I'm in the neighborhood and I can maintain a lot more pressure on everybody than everybody else can. Cervello?
I'm worried about two things that I'm worried about, as you alluded to early in the discussion, the administration's commitment to this and what that ambiguity potentially means for the strategic messaging. In terms of, you know, do the Chinese really believe that we will follow through on the threats that we are trying to deter? Do they believe that we will actually, whether it's shoulder or whether it's actually go to some low level kinetic operation, you know, do the Chinese believe we'll actually follow through with it? Do the individual commanders believe that the administration will follow through and have their back if something goes wrong? Secondly is, I mean, the messaging to the force, and is the force ready to do this type of step up? I think yes. I mean, I do think that we have a very capable and competent force. I just think that you have some, you have some challenges in terms of making sure that they're ready, making sure that they understand that, hey, we weren't just kind of hanging out, as Chris Cavas alluded, with Truman and others to beat the virus, that there is a reason that we're out there, and there is a reason that we are the first line of deterrence and the first line of defense away from home. And so making sure that folks are focused. Again, it goes back to that the Navy is squeezed a little bit. They're squeezed between the administration's commitment and making sure that the sailors understand what they need to be focused on right now.
We have to go into a bit of a lightning round, given we are very, very short on time, but I want to ask each of you very quickly kind of a conjoined question. So we have a new Navy secretary who's coming in. That Navy secretary is coming in at a time when there's an investigation ongoing into the TR episode that was called for by Defense Secretary Esper and Chairman Milley, and an investigation that ultimately could change the leadership outlook that the Navy has enjoyed in the Pacific for the past 75 years. Ultimately, it may be very, very hard for the senior Navy leaders in the region, whether it's Long Aquilino or Bill Mers, to fleet up to become PAC fleet and then go from PAC fleet to PACOM, which has been the historic route as that job has stayed in Navy hands for decades. And there is a concern that folks have, certainly on the Navy side, that this sort of paves the way for that job to either go to the Air Force and then ultimately go to the Army, which is something that Army leaders have always been interested in. At the end of the day, let's start with Brian, Chris, and Chris. What's the advice to Secretary Braithwaite as he takes office? And what are the prospects for a change in leadership in the Pacific away from the Navy? And what does that mean?
I wrote some advice in a recent blog post called Some Unsolicited Advice to the Secretary of the Navy. But I think the most important thing he can do is to do no harm. Specifically, with respect to this investigation, he should be a frictionless pipe. He should add no value to it. He should take no value from it. He should just transmit it to the Secretary of Defense. It was all before him. I think he ought to just let the thing go. As for the leadership change or potential leadership change in the Pacific, I don't think that Pacific Command is a birthright of naval officers. I think that if you take jointness seriously, you have to make some room for the fact that other services might eventually have command of those regions. I would like to get to the bottom of this and to know exactly what the influence of the Pacific Commander and the Pacific Fleet Commander were on the TR before I talk about whether they will continue to move on or not.
And obviously, right, I'm not saying that any of this is nefarious, nor am I trying to imply that either Long Aquilino or Admiral Mers did anything wrong. But as a general rule, we find in this modern era that if there's an investigation, you know what I mean? Investigations have a tendency of turning something up or make an issue of something that might not otherwise be an issue to justify the investigation, right? I mean, there's sometimes damage.
Investigations always find something.
Correct. Cervello, briefly.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm where Brian is. I think that long before this, there was a real belief among those folks that handicap these types of issues that the Air Force was going to get PACOM next. Whether this solidifies that or whether, you know, this investigation makes that more likely, I don't know. But I mean, I think that in the long term, I think that you'll see a Air Force PACOM, you'll see an Army PACOM, and probably move to a rotating position. In terms of Secretary Braithwaite, I think, you know, again, in alignment with Brian said, I think the best thing that Secretary Braithwaite can do is be a trusted agent, both of the uniform leadership. The uniform folks need to feel that he has their back. And I think Secretary Esper needs to feel that he has his back. And I think that will go a long way in making many of the issues that we've seen and read about coming out of the Pentagon. I think it'll help stabilize the whole situation if he can be that important interlocutor between the uniform side and the third deck there in the Pentagon.
Thomas?
I think Secretary Braithwaite is between a rock and a hard place. Secretary Esper is not viewed by most observers as being supportive of the Navy. This investigation is, it's hard to say why this investigation is continuing to go on. It would appear, Roger, that the investigation isn't over. Roger, there's a lot of things we don't know, but we've seen plenty and seen enough to know that just about everybody involved in here has some culpability. And that starts with the carrier's command, through his strike group commander, through the fleet commanders, through the PACOM, up into Washington, up in, through the Department of Defense and into the White House. Everybody screwed this up. Nobody is pure here. And if you want to go ahead and just blame everybody, and then what are you going to do? Clearly, this was a screw up. Clearly, theoretically, you've learned from it. The pronouncements now by all Navy senior leadership, including the CNO, is that we've learned from this. We've changed our processes. We think we have a handle on it now. We're trying to get past this and learn. So right now, I mean, I don't see anybody. I see nobody who's pure. And anybody who wants to start excoriating the Navy for this, who's not in the Navy, well, what did you do to make this easier too? First rule of any commander when your people screw up, what could you have done to have prevented this from happening? And that's a question I don't think anybody's going to ask here. So Braithwaite, is he going to be a yes man for the Pentagon, which probably is what they're looking for? Is he going to be an advocate for his service, which ultimately, arguably, is the role of a service secretary? What's he going to do for the rest of the year, 7-8 months? I don't know. It's a tough job, you know. Ride the wave and see what happens. But there's nothing good will come out of this investigation. That's for sure. Certainly, just not a good thing.
Ryan, 30 seconds. I want to finish with you. Are you concerned that a bipolar approach from the United States, where there is muscularity on, for example, the military side or parts of the national security apparatus, and less muscularity on the part of the president and maybe some other folks in the White House, whether that sets a potential or increases the risk for potential miscalculation?
I don't think this is a particularly deft bunch when it comes to strategy, but I do think there is some value to a carrots and sticks approach. Although I think the carrots, specifically the trade deal and the mania for trade deal with China, has probably taken on way too much importance relative to the sticks, which is the deterrent posture and the assurance and the, you know, make no bones about our will kind of approach.
I think it's going to be very, very interesting whether the United States can capitalize on this to bring all of its allies together to create sort of a more global bulwark against bad Chinese behavior. I want to thank each of you very much for joining us today. Thank you very much. Hope all the best to you, yours, and hope you guys have a tremendous Memorial Day weekend, or as tremendous as you can make it while not being able to get out too far from home. Thanks very much again to you all.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us. Please follow our daily interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report. That's at DefAero Report. Like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And check out our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. For more than 80 years, Bell has pushed past the boundaries of what's possible to drive aviation forward, going above and beyond flight. BellFlight.com. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.